as possible.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about this very lively current debate in the literary community about representation, who gets to write about what, and what kind of character? I know you've been thinking out loud about this stuff. Would love to hear.
Yeah, it's totally, look, I mean, what's been going on for most, for all of human history is that, or at least the vast majority of it, civilized, what we call civilized, which is actually the most barbarous and brutal, but whatever, you know what I mean? Recent history, history that's written down, is really the story of white guys, more or less, or guys with power anyway, always men, almost entirely, 99.999% powerful men, usually powerful European men. And that's been history. And there has been not a complete absence, but a severe underrepresentation of the lives of different people. This is why, you know, Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States is so powerful, because it says, wait a second, stop looking at Columbus. What about the Taino Indians? What about the native people, et cetera? And that debate, which is in certain precincts, is being, you know, furiously fought against by people who are taking up arms to try to protect some kind of fantasized version, fear of a brown planet. In other precincts, like the literary world, there is a long overdue reckoning with the fact that guys who look like me and guys and straight hetero white guys have been the predominant voices in literature, and that that is excluding and not making space for a whole range of stories that exist alongside white guys that need to be heard. I think that's long overdue, and I think that there's a fair argument to be made that the people who should tell those stories are the people who have lived them. That there are great pieces of writing by Luis Urrea, anything he writes, Children of the Land. Is another, you know, fantastic. I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. There are all these amazing books that are told by Latinx people, that are written by Latinx people who have lived the experience of their characters. I think that's great. For me, I was not thinking, I would like to choose somebody other than me to write about for this novel. I really, the muse delivered Lorena Sines to me, and Jenny Stallworth and all the other characters in the book, but Lorena was the one that I was most drawn to. And that was probably from reading lots of Dickens, where all these, you know, young intrepid characters, or Jane Eyre or whatever, who are up against it. But the other thing is, when you're writing, you, for me anyway, you're not thinking about, well, what are the representation issues? And later on, you definitely should. But for me, I'm thinking, okay, Lorena's just done this. What does that mean? What kind of danger is she in now? How is she going to get out of it? Is she going to save herself and her people? Those are the questions that I'm asking. After I finished the book, I definitely thought about, oh my gracious, I appear to have written a book that's way outside of my experience, which, by the way, is a good thing. If I was only writing about my experience, I would be centering straight white male stories. You know, sort of told about whatever stuff that's interesting, like the creative, you know, sort of your creative aspirations or self-actualization or family dynamics. Those are all great and important subjects. But because of my political and moral preoccupations, I think my subconscious needed me to write a social novel, needed me to write a novel that was a dramatization of things that I've written about elsewhere, sort of in a much more finger-wagging way. I wanted to bring myself and a bunch of readers into a drama where they could see everybody can act in the best motives, and these larger corrupt systems are still going to create terrible outcomes. After finishing it, I sort of thought, okay, I've done this. I believe in what I've done. I think artists have to have the freedom to morally imagine their way into other kinds of lives. That's really their job. If they want to enlarge the reader's moral imagination, they have to enlarge their own, but they better get it right if they're writing from a position of privilege about characters who are disenfranchised. So I set about, I did a lot of research, but I also set about sending the manuscript out to pretty much everybody who I thought might be able to help me. Certainly Latinx friends, a cultural sensitivity reader, a police officer who was an officer during the time in question, my friend Paul Salopek, who was a brilliant reporter, grew up in Mexico and was a brilliant reporter on the border and knew a lot about immigration and had written about that extensively. Female, my wife certainly, and lots of women who I thought would be able to offer some perspective on how the female characters are portrayed, just as many beta readers as I could. And ultimately, the reader gets to decide whether, whether it feels like a fair and accurate portrayal. The only thing that I can say is that my effort is to understand all the characters and to be merciful towards them, not absolve them, but to understand what their motives are. And that to me counts pretty much as most important. If, especially if you're gonna write outside of your experience, you better not be flattening anybody out into a caricature.
Did anything surprise you as you were listening to Lorena's voice as you were writing her through the book?
Well, one thing that surprised me is that she kept putting herself into dangerous situations. And I am a, maybe as a writer, I can have a little more courage, but I'm generally a pretty frightened person, anxious person. And I was sort of astonished, maybe that was part of the pleasure of spending time with her, that she just wouldn't give up. She was absolutely dogged, and she kept making decisions that, you're saying as a reader, don't do that, don't do that. And also sort of maybe more quietly, oh good, she's gonna do that. Oh good, she's gonna do that. Because it's just such a pleasure to encounter somebody like that who is going to have to do extraordinary things in order to even have a chance of transcending the story that she's born into. So her courageousness surprised and delighted me continually. Mm-hmm.
Another element in your sort of teaching style has been your portraying sex and sexuality in a direct and engaged manner. You teach writers not to avoid sexual interactions between characters. And it made me curious about your nickname for your protagonist, Lo. It harkened to Lolita, the classic book that is sort of the most classic white male gaze and sexualized girl in literature.
Yes.
In your book, and I'm going to try to stay vague for spoiler reasons, but you
sure.
Shift into sexuality from the vantage point of a girl in early adolescence, and sort of flipping the Lolita script.
Yep.
Can you speak to your challenge in trying to bring emotional truth to that sort of aspect of her life?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a very vulnerable, risky proposition.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think, quite foolish to imagine that children and especially adolescents don't have a sexual life. They do. They also have very little power and very little understanding of what they're up to. That doesn't mean they don't have bodies and urges. And for me, like the nickname Lo is given to her by Rosemary Stallworth. It's a bit of a wink to the reader, but it's also, hey, that is what's happening to her. There's a certain kind of possession that is taken of her by each of the Stallworth parents for different reasons. It's inherently exploitative. And the central work for me was not to deny that she would have this insane crush, and that it would be partly from the regard that Marcus Stallworth gives her, the respect, the understanding, the connection that they have, having really led lives that are more similar than other characters in the book, because Marcus has had a very hard shake in things, as we've come to find out, but that there is as well an undeniable, though ambiguous, charge between them that, again, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it's not what their relationship is built on. I think their relationship is built on a sense of being sort of akin in some way, having the scientific mind and this desire to sort of get away from the fraudulence of this sort of suburban world. But there is, in addition to that, as part of the engine of their interaction, certainly from Lorena's point of view, she is really, in a way that she cannot control, excited by and turned on by this guy. And I think it's foolish for us to imagine that is not how adolescents operate. They get intense crushes all the time, and sometimes they act on them in small and large ways, and regardless of whether they act on them in the real world, they're powerful within their inner life. And that's, I think, what I was trying to get at, is that part of what is exciting for Lorena walking into the Stallworth house is the sense of ease and assurance, of money, of a larger life, of ambition, of being visible. And in addition to all that, a male figure who sees her, respects her, and gives her just enough, a certain kind of attention to really trigger her sense of sort of erotic excitement in ways that, you know, are disturbing but also real. I really hate when we pretend that we don't have these powerful libidinal urges. That's why I talk about writing sex, because people have sex and it's important to them. And even if they're just having fantasy or, you know, solo sex, those are still sexual experiences. It's not the only show, but it's part of what makes us who we are. We all have an erotic and sexual life, and so your characters should too.
There's a phrase I've read in essays that you've written that I really like, that about the subject. You say, writing sex scenes is building psychologically and emotionally reliable on-ramps to moments that really matter.
I mean, I think that's true of any kind of scene, but certainly when the only reason to have a scene with sex in it in a book is because you're stripping the characters naked emotionally and psychologically. We are all, when it comes time to be in a sexual situation, sort of hopeful and ecstatic and anxious, you know, and hyped up. It matters to us a lot. We're paying careful attention. Somebody could get hurt. Somebody could get great pleasure, which is also frightening to us. There's a lot at stake. And what I believe generally, whether it's a scene that is sexual or a scene that involves conflict or a scene that involves a sort of sudden revelation, a physical risk or a moral or psychic risk, is that our job is to build, as writers, is to build that ramp that feels reliable to these particular moments where a lot is at stake, and then to slow down as the action's unfolding so that we can move inside the character's experiences.
So more personally, it seems like the voice in this novel shifts away from what people sort of know as the Steve Almond voicey, humorous, sarcastic voice that we all love in stories and other books. Does it reflect for you a shift in where you might be standing and looking at your life in the world?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was thinking about this because a lot of this novel, I think, arises from the coincidence of having gone to El Paso, Texas, right after I graduated college. And when you're in El Paso, suddenly the story of immigration and the border, which is, you know, demagogued in a very ridiculous invading army, all this nonsense. When you're there, you really realize, oh, it's just like having a very, 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 very poor country up against a very rich country. It's just natural that people are going to want, who are ambitious and who want to lead a larger life and give opportunity to their kids. They're naturally going to want to come to the United States. When I was 21, 22, 23, 24 in El Paso, I saw that, I absorbed it. I could see the day maids coming across the Rio Grande from a little balcony. If I got up early enough, I could see all of the pathos of their, you know, carrying their work clothes on their head in a plastic sack and scampering up the other side of the Rio Grande and having to, you know, change their clothes at dawn and hope they weren't going to get chased down by an INS van and so forth. I could see it, but it doesn't mean I was ready to write about it or that I really understood it. It was just me witnessing something, and it kind of stayed unresolved. I was aware of it, but I wasn't engaged with it. In fact, it took me like 20, 25 years for me to write the story, My Life in Heavy Metal, maybe 20 years after I was in El Paso, or maybe 15. I wrote a story that focused on my experience in El Paso, but it was like my job as a newspaper pop critic and covering these heavy metal concerts and sort of the sexual idiocy of my insecurity causing me to behave badly in relationships, And that was really what I was ready to write about at that time. I was ready to take on that part of the El Paso experience. Well, that's me, you know, at 35 saying, okay, I can start to get a little bit of purchase on the kind of idiot that I was. Another 15 years and whatever America has gone through, this kind of moral regression that we're suffering through, I think I'm thinking about, and I have three kids of my own, I'm thinking about things a little bit more deeply. And now when El Paso returns to me, it really is the issue of what I was witnessing and what it is, what immigration really means and what it means to be an undocumented person, what it means to suffer the possibility of deportation at a moment's notice versus the insane sort of accident of being born American, the flukiness of it, and the sense in which we somehow view that as like an achievement or a birthright. It's just dumb luck. And when you live on the border, you realize that very powerfully because there's a line. And at night, when you look out, the lights in El Paso are all bright and the lights in Juarez were sort of speckled blue. Even at night, you could tell where that line was. And it was an arbitrary line. It was a man-made line. Scorpions didn't know about that line. Right, the natural world said, what are you talking about? This is just a, you know, ridiculous arbitrary thing that's been created by human beings. So I think for me, like trying to take that on took a lot longer for me to say, well, maybe there was something more serious. And honestly, the early novels that I wrote were full of me being glib and clever and trying to sort of entertain the reader, because I think I didn't really have a story to tell. The muse hadn't walked me into, or walked somebody like Lorena into my imagination. And so I tried to sort of get by on shtick. And that doesn't go, you know, you can get away with that for a few paragraphs or a few pages, but you can't for a whole book, because the reader wants story. Mm-hmm. They want to care about somebody, and they want that somebody put into danger, and they want to know whether that somebody's going to survive it. Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about other titles you're mentioning, like Candy Freak and Against Football. You were confronting your own obsessions in those moments, yep. Right, with watching sports. And is there a confrontation with self that played out as you were creating this novel, sort of as a...
Yeah, I mean, I think...
called it being born on third base.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I was trying to do is stop writing about me and my life, even though obviously I think we're always writing autobiographically. It was a greater act of imagination for me to say, all right, who is Guerrero, the police officer who's a central character? Who is Lorena? Who is Tony, her older brother? Who is Graciela, her mom? Who are these people? Who are the stalwarts? Because I'm not actually similar to anybody in the book, maybe come closest in being sort of a jerk soccer player like Glenn Stallworth, the older brother of Jenny, but there really isn't anybody who maps out to my own particular experience. My job was to sort of figure out who all the characters were and what it was that they were, the secrets that they were keeping. The other thing that made the book easier to write was that everybody in this house of freaks that Lorena walks into is bearing a secret or two. And some of them are secrets that they're keeping from the world, and the most interesting and dangerous ones are the secrets that they're keeping from themselves. I think that was something I learned from working on Dear Sugars, was that really the most dangerous secrets are the ones that we just can't even admit to ourselves. We're unaware of them. We're keeping them a secret from themselves. You know, things like this relationship is no longer serving me and I have to get out. Like, that's a secret that a lot of people keep from themselves. Or another secret is that, you know, we'll tell ourselves the story that really what needs to happen is for our partner or for our child to behave differently, and they need to change how they're doing business, when the truth is actually we're the ones who need to change. I've run into that one a lot.
Did writing the book change you in ways that you didn't expect?
I think it allowed me to take myself a little bit more seriously. Not, I guess what I mean is that at the same time I was just chasing Lorena, I think I was realizing, oh, this is what it feels like when a big story is working. And you don't have to just keep trying to charm the reader and desperately flogging the language. Your job is to just be curious and humble and patient and let the characters and their experience be the center of it. And in a way, one thing I realized is that the kind of preachy narrator that is, I think, predominates in some of my nonfiction, where in Bad Stories or Against Football, there's a part of me that's sort of saying, ah, look at this terrible, corrupt, you know, situation. That in a novel, your job is, it belongs, the story belongs to the characters and their experiences in a moment-to-moment way, not to the noble views of the author. Those were sort of broadcast in early drafts of the novel in the voice of this narrator who would kind of hover above and sort of observe things and tell the reader, here's the lesson. And it was awful. And I got rid of almost all of it because I realized that that was me playing God again and condescending to the characters and to the reader, frankly. Readers get it. You read the book. I don't need to explain. I can talk a little bit about, well, here's what I was interested in, you know, ex post facto, but the reader gets it. And I think a lot of what I was able to do is realize, oh yeah, the reader gets the experience of being in the story. The reader doesn't need a commentator. They don't need help understanding what it all means. Just stay with the characters, stay with them in their moments of danger.
That's so interesting because part of what you're saying does sound like, this might be a little cheesy, but it's like you sniffed out anything that might be construed as sort of explaining or...
Oh, yeah.
Or yeah, because, teaching, yeah. You know, and that is such a up and back way to view who you're engaging with as the reader.
I mean, interestingly, you know me as a teacher, and a lot of people know me. That's good. That's a great... It's important to be able to explain to you. But the thing about being a teacher is that you're hung up on mastery. You know, I know my rap. I know what I want to say. It's easy for me to diagnose, you know, what's going on with a piece of writing or to explain it. That's not a position of humility. That's a position of kind of moral surety, you know, like, oh, I know exactly what the problem is. It's much more interesting to ultimately to get rid of that, all of that, the didactic part of myself. And I could feel myself in the narrator cleaving to that, just making sure that the student got the lesson. But this isn't a lesson. It's a story. And in a story, what you get to do is allow the reader or compel the reader into the experience of the characters. And then you have to trust that the reader is not your student. The reader is another human being who's hearing your story. And they're not looking for a lesson. They're looking for an experience. They're looking for an emotional event. And it took me a while. That was later drafts where gradually, I promise you, I got rid of almost every single moment where that narrator is butting in and saying, you see the evil, you see the corruption. It's like, dude, just shut up. Save it for a nonfiction book. Or maybe even just get rid of it all together.
I mean, I would argue, having read the book, it makes the kind of lurching consequences of sort of the machines, the deadly machines of the powers that be, more devastating to be in a closer up to it without any abstraction, without any commentary.
Right.
That's part of what made this book so beautifully painful. It was so painful.
Yeah. It's tough, and people will tell me that, and you know, there's part of me that almost, like you were saying, this isn't the funny, you know, Steve Almond, whatever. You know, I have a sort of reputation for using the comic impulse as a way of kind of softening, and though there are, I think, moments of a little bit of levity in this book, it's quite serious, and it's quite grave and sad. I almost want to like apologize to people and say like, it's kind of upsetting what happens, but also the world's upsetting. And I see no reason to, like, I'm not a big fan of kind of worrying about the reader being okay It's more that I don't want people to feel who have a certain idea of the kind of experience they're going to have to be like, geez, that was dark. And it is dark, but look around. It's a dark season that we're in. And, you know, the novelist, the writer is absorbing what's happening in the zeitgeist around them. And if they want to accurately reflect what's really going on, they have to be able to say, the characters are not all going to be all right. That's not really, that's a fairy tale. That's not reality. For me, part of the problem with the Reagan Revolution, which is, you know, what I'm sort of morally interrogating here, is that it was predicated on a myth, on a fairy tale, that the United States and America is this great mansion on the hill. And, you know, you do not get to ask the relevant questions. Who's living in the mansion? Who's cleaning the mansion, right? You know, who's scrubbing the floors, and who's going to get arrested if they trespass on the mansion? Those are the questions that we should have been asking, not because Reagan was necessarily in bad faith. I think he believed it, but he was a salesman. He was a marketer, and we are swimming in marketing. That is, in not just corporate marketing. Now we're all marketing ourselves on Facebook and the other social media apps, and art. Sure. And, yeah, right. Our job is to try to undo all that and say, actually, this is the way the world really works. It can be upsetting, but unless we face it, like Baldwin says, you cannot hope to solve problems that you refuse to confront.
There's something beautiful about the way it makes it, you as the writer, more vulnerable, actually, to bring forward, this is my emotional metabolism of what we're living in, without, you know, things we love about your writing. But to sort, it does make you seem to sort of take a coat off and yourself even more forward.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good way of putting it. It's like, you know, it's not that I've been horsing around, or that I haven't been sort of grappling with what's happening in our country, but I don't think I was doing that. I think I was doing that sort of with my superego. And this one, I really wanted to put all of myself into it and enter into the experience of the characters. And that's why when I later in the book, I found myself sinking into these characters and saying, what is lodged in their history that is going to determine how they behave and whether they're okay in the end? And they're not all going to be okay. And it's because they've suffered certain things. And unless I can go back and suffer with them, the reader won't fully understand it. And I think that is, you know, that's what I've been up to in some ways in short stories and some of my nonfiction, but not in as sustained a way. That's the way I would say it, not in that sustained way.
And just what you're saying makes me feel like that kind of mechanism of the more that deeply you embedded yourself in the subconscious motivations, or, you know, the deeper emotional life of them, the more you're able to be invisible as the narrator, the more you're able to sort of get to be more invisible as you're more present. I guess I just love that juxtaposition that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the goal, is for me to kind of disappear into the characters. And I think that was the pleasure of it, because in a way I was tired of myself. And I think, I'm not saying that like negatively, but I was tired of writing in the mode of like, okay, let me look at my life and mine it. What am I, you know, candy, football, rock and roll? And it's like, enough. I want to have my own moral imagination enlarged. I want to enter into these characters and these places. And it was really for me during the pandemic, which is when the second half of the book was written, it was a respite. You know, go away to we'd go get these little cheap Airbnbs. My wife and I, she's a writer too. We'd take every other month, we'd go off for, you know, 6 or 7 days. And for me to get out of the pressure cooker of what was happening and be able to enter this world was, I think, both artistic progress, but also a great pleasure in a way. It brought me into an imagined world in a much more sustained way than I'd been able to do before. And, you know, so that's why I'm very happy that the book got finished. I don't really, I mean, I'm delighted that it's in the world, but for me, the achievement was even in occupying that imagined space.
And being able to sustain yourself in that space through to you and your characters arriving at the the ending together, it sounds really satisfying.
Especially, well, the ending was tough because I worked on it really hard. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want, you know, I got notes from people that I respect saying, does it have to be so dark? And then the real question for me was like, well, maybe it doesn't, but if it's going to, if there's going to be some hope, it's got to be earned. It's got to be Lorena figuring out with help in the right moments, figuring out a way through, not to like bliss or happiness, but just to a place where her full potential is realized. And that, for me, that was very exciting. You'll also probably notice that there are a lot of teachers in this book, and that the teachers play an important role. So that was important for me too.
So I found parallels between the novel and God Bless America. I was thinking about the two in comparison with each other, because they both get at the fate of America and the thorniness coming back to the American dream, which are painfully laid out in the novel, like the versions of the American dream played out. Where do you see the American dream today, given, especially today, with attacks on women's freedom and in this moment?
I mean, yeah, the pendulum swings, you know, and two things can happen at the same time that are moving in opposite directions, you know. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you can have an increasing sense of enlightenment, really, when it comes to, I don't know, stuff like how gender is defined and how people's sexuality is defined. You can have an increasing sense of tolerance, you know, for instance, for gay people, you know, the LGBTQ, there's much greater awareness.